well. Let's pick it up. All right. Creation in the beginning. That is the title of the class. And, of course, we're going to start from the beginning. I think tonight's class will be primarily introductory, and we will attempt to move along as the weeks go on. Now, we have to start any class with creation. We have to begin with the statement of the sages in the Mishnah in Tractate Chagiga. They say that you have to be very selective about teaching creation. Gracious. When you teach creation, you have to be very careful. You have to be careful about how many students you teach it to. There's a difference of opinion there, whether you're allowed to teach it to only two students at a time or only one student at a time. What's the fear? The fear is that when it comes to these issues of creation, you're dealing with very serious matters about belief and about God and about what was there before, etc. And there is a concern that if you have too many students at a time, perhaps one of them will become disinterested and his mind will begin to wander and he'll pick up words here and words there and misconstrue what the teacher is saying and end up with serious flaws in his or her belief. So one has to be very careful. And obviously we have a class here of more than two students, which is fine because we're not going to be as in-depth as the Talmud is referring to. The Talmud is referring to studying creation in the great depth that the Talmud approaches it, which is really beyond the understanding of most Talmudic scholars today. So that we're not concerned now about how many students, but it is worthwhile to keep in mind that we have to be careful about the issues of belief. Now, let me begin with the following question. And really, it's a question about whether there is a question. We have several people in the room. We all come from different walks of life. We all have different experiences. We have here, in the beginning of Bereishis, 31 verses. Come on in. We have 31 verses that teach us about the first 6 days of creation. Has anybody here have questions about these 31 verses?
Yes.
You have a question. Okay. Who doesn't have questions? Go ahead, you start us off, Yisrael.
All right, one question is...
Stop, just give us one. Everybody can only say one. Pick your biggest question.
The biggest question is, if the sun wasn't and moon wasn't created until later in the week, how can you have evening and morning at the beginning of the week?
Good question. Okay, Yisrael's asking a good question. We know that the sun and moon were created, it seems, on day four, and yet you have... What's the specific...
Erev.
Okay, you have morning and night on already day one. Night and day on day one. How can that be if there was no sun and moon? Good question. Anybody else?
Well, corollary question.
Corollary question,
yes. If the God created the plants before the sun, did he not, like, third day or something, and then there's...
Okay. Plants are already on day three as the vegetation of
light for photosynthesis.
Okay, so we know scientifically they need light, and if there's no light yet, how can there be vegetation on day three? Okay, good question. Go ahead. Can you tell me your name, please?
Rachel.
Okay, go ahead.
In some places, mostly, I feel that Hashem created the world from nothing. But in some places, I read that he created the world from four substances: water, earth, fire, and air.
Okay.
So, how to reconcile this, the things that people read about, and what is this before, and who created what was before?
Okay. Did he create it from nothing, or did he create it from four substances? Four substances, which would be fire, water, earth, and air. Okay. Okay, very good. Very good. Okay. Oh, do we have enough chairs? Are we going to chairs? We can grab a few more.
Okay. We're going to need a lot more kamashi.
You know what? I don't think you have to go, because this class is really going to be more introductory, so we don't really need in the future everybody was going to need a stone chumash, but for this evening we're okay the way we are. Let's just wait till everybody has a chance to find a seat. Here, they're bringing in more chairs right over there. There's a seat over here. Okay. Okay, I realize this is going to be somewhat distracting, but would you mind ripping out a page from your notebook and passing it around as a sign-up sheet? This is the only way I'm going to learn the names, is if I see the sheet, I get a chance to look at people's names, and that way, over time, I'll figure out who's who. So if you don't mind just passing it, as the sheet comes to you, please write your name on the sheet so I'll know who, at least I'll know who is here. I'll have a chance.
Should people maybe put phone numbers in case there's a reason to contact?
That would be a good idea. That would be a good idea. Okay, thank you. That's a good idea. Okay, so our first question was, we're going around the room asking, does anybody have a strong question about the first 6 days of creation, of which we have 31 verses here in the Chumash? So our first question was, how could there be evening and morning if there's no sun and moon until day four? How can you have evening and morning already in day one? Next question was, how can there be vegetation growing on day three if there was no sun and moon until day four? How did the vegetation grow without photosynthesis? And now we have a question, did God create the earth from nothing, or were there four substances, fire, water, air, and earth? And it all comes from that. Anybody else with one question? You only get one.
Well, there was light and darkness,
right,
before there was sun, moon, stars.
Okay.
So where did this light come from?
Where did the light come from? Light and darkness without any sun, moon, or stars.
And why did it go away?
And what did it happen to it? Good question.
Isn't that the same as question one?
Similar to question one. Similar question. The question was focusing on day and night, and okay. This question is
focusing on light.
Light, yeah. Anything else?
Adam ate the apple. Hashem knew he was going to eat the apple.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Explain that.
God knows it's going to happen. Then, how can he? Where's the free will? Okay, that's really after the first 6 days of creation, but it's a very good question because it cuts to the chase of what creation is all about, which is about free will, about human beings making choices. It's a good question.
And now I'm not sure, maybe this was the garden, that tree that was in the middle.
Right.
What was the point of even mentioning that if we never hear about it or need to know about it?
You mean the tree of life?
Yeah.
Okay, good question. What's the deal with the tree of life? If it's not even, nobody eats from it, and it's put away, and et cetera. That's also after the first 6 days, and we'll have to get to that, but not tonight.
Okay.
I'll have to get to it. Okay? Okay, anybody else? Yes?
Why is the Nachash, the snake, the only one created with arms, legs, and speech ability, like Adam and Chava?
Okay.
If its essence is known, what makes it so special, and why, if that was a risk, why even give it that possibility?
Okay, why is the snake given the gift of speech? And also, it seems we don't know exactly what the nature of his ability to move or hands or whatever. But it seems he's much more human-like than the other animals. And why is that so? Why should the snake be given that power? Okay, good question. Yeah.
If Hashem created the world in 6 days, are each of those days the same length of time? And how is that length determined before there's sun and moon?
Okay, what is this length of time of the first 6 days? I like the way you asked the question. The question, the way it's being asked, is that forget the issue of how old the world is, but how can there even be a measure of time if you don't have the sun, stars, etc.? Well, the way we measure time is based on revolutions of the heavenly bodies. How do you have time if you don't have anything going around anything? There's just the earth, apparently, and no sun, moon, stars, etc. Good question. Anything else?
Mr. Kohler talked about Adam and Chava, that Hashem knew that he would do that, and then you mentioned free will, and I was just wondering, just because Hashem knows what we're going to do, how does that interfere with our free will?
Okay, so what you're saying is that the two things are not in conflict. And you're correct. They're not in conflict. But many people have a difficulty understanding why those two things are not in conflict. In many people's minds, if I know what you're going to do before you do it, then you don't really have a choice of what to do, because I already know what you're going to do. And if you say no, okay? Okay. You know what? I don't want to get sidetracked on that issue, but I want to hear what you have to say. And I don't want to forget that you have what to say on this. So you have the question and you have the answer, okay? And we do not want to forget it. Tell me your name. Tell me your name again. First name?
Larry.
Larry, and again, your name?
Sheila Blatch.
Okay, so we have Larry and Sheila. I don't want to forget that we have the good question and the good answer. And when we get to this topic, which we, please God, we'll get to in the next few weeks, please remember to speak up. And don't let me just, you know, run right over it without getting to you. Okay. Anything else before we move on? You think I'm going to answer all these questions? That's the funny part.
Three of them are closely related.
A lot of them are related. Okay. Okay. Let's first address... Let's talk about creation in general. This is a general point. We begin, as you know, with Bereishis Bara Elokim Eis HaShemayim Ve'Eis HaAretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, what does it mean, the heavens, and what does it mean, the earth? First verse in the Torah, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What are the heavens, and what's the earth? Well, I don't even want to translate it that way. In the beginning, God created, let's translate it literally. You got to say everything literally. Es HaShamayim, He created, that's heavens. Ves HaAretz, and the land. Isn't that what Aretz means? Or, I don't even know, how do they say it in the English over here? They say the earth. Anybody want to take a stab at it? What is the heavens? Is the atmosphere the heavens? Is the solar system the heavens? What are the heavens?
I've always originally thought of it as being the place we look forward to going to in the future. That.
Okay, so you're saying the heavens is not this world. The heavens is?
The next world.
The next world.
Well, your angels created before all this stuff.
Again, angels were created. No.
Angels
already
exist at that time.
No.
What angels were created?
The Talmud explains, based on the verses, which we'll get to later, that the angels were created on day two. On day one, God was alone. Nothing else. No being was created other than God. God was the only one who lived at that time.
So is this the spiritual place then where the angels will be?
That's what Yisrael is suggesting. That Shamayim refers to the spiritual realm. And that is correct. When it says heavens in the first verse, it is referring to the spiritual realm. Aretz, the earth... Earth is not really an accurate translation. The Aretz in the first verse refers to the physical realm. In other words, the way you can translate the first verse is, in the beginning God created the spiritual realm, and God created the physical realm, which means Aretz is the entire physical universe. The entire physical universe is included in the word Eretz. Now, you'll say, but what do you mean, Rabbi? The word Eretz, anybody who speaks Hebrew knows, the word Eretz means land. Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Canaan. Eretz Mitzrayim. I mean, what do you mean, universe? It doesn't mean the universe of Mitzrayim. It means the land of Mitzrayim. So, what am I talking about? And your point would be well taken. Eretz does not mean universe. Eretz means land. But, that's because something changed. Now, I know that not everybody has a chumash, and I don't want to get bogged down in the text tonight because not everybody has one in front of them. This is going to be, I hope, the one reference that you'll have, and I will say it slowly for anybody who doesn't have it in front of them. You'll see. I hope it'll be clear. On day two, it says God created the rakia. He created rakia means it means something up there that we see, either the atmosphere or the solar system. He's created something on that level that we see up at night or during the day. I'm not sure which. But at any rate, then it says, Vayikra Elokim Larakia Shamayim. God called the Rakia Shamayim. Now, on day one it says, God created HaShamayim. And then it says, God called the Rakia Shamayim. One second. I thought God created Shamayim on day one. And now on day two, it says He called the Rakia Shamayim. Does that mean that there are two Shamayims? That they one Shamayim and they two Shamayim? And if there are two, why is God confusing us? Why would He call Rakia Shamayim if there already is a Shamayim? That would be like, I name my first son Shimon, that is his name, and then I name my third son Shimon, just because, why not? Let's confuse everybody. Isn't that what God is doing?
George Foreman did that.
George Foreman did that. Okay. Okay. So, or better yet, you name your third son a different name, and then you say, you know what, I'll call him Shimon, just to confuse everybody. He creates Shamayim on day one, creates Rakia on day two, and then he calls Rakia Shamayim. Thanks a lot. How are we supposed to stay? Yes.
Shamayim is plural, right?
Well, yes. Yeah, it would seem that it's plural.
What's the singular?
I don't know if there is a singular.
You always refer to heaven as heaven.
Right. Because that's, we're translating it, you know, the
maybe
name.
That's a hint. There's
the name,
two.
What's the name for face in Hebrew? Who knows the name for face in Hebrew? Ashena?
Panim.
Panim. Right? Panim. Panim is plural. Right. But you don't say faces in English. Because in English we say face. But in Hebrew the word is panim. And there doesn't seem to be a singular. Or if there is a singular, it's probably the verb panah, which means to turn or to face something. Uh-huh. Right? So Shamayim, although it is plural, it does not seem to have a singular form, at least not in common usage. Now, so you're suggesting if it's plural, maybe that means that there are two of them. Is that what you mean to say?
That's what.
But even on day one, it calls it Shamayim in the plural.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, you want to say? Go ahead.
Well, the translation that I've heard goes more along with the way they have it in the Sfan Chumash,
mm-hmm.
in the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth.
Okay.
But it doesn't say He created the heavens and earth, period, past.
Okay, that is Rashi renders the pasuk in that way, in the beginning of the creation of the heavens and the earth, in the beginning of God's creating the heavens and the earth, the following is what took place. But still, that would still suggest that the heavens are there before the Torah starts writing. Then you'd bring up the other question, which is, was there something there before God, before this verse? Obviously, God is the first thing that exists. But does the Torah start truly in the beginning? Is the Torah starting really at the beginning, or is the Torah starting a little bit into time already? Which is also a good point.
Well, don't you learn later that there's seven levels to heaven? Like, why are you stuck on two? Like, couldn't it be seven, and then each one could have a differentiation within it?
Okay.
You know.
Very good.
Like, so I'm not stuck on two like you are.
Okay. Okay. I'm more concerned not with the fact that there are two, but the fact that God calls Rakia Shamayim.
But
why?
Maybe one of them or a group of them could be Rakia. Because even later, when the waters, there's the upper waters and lower
true.
Waters.
True.
Some of the upper waters go up to the Rakia or Shemayim, you know, like you have to figure out what it is. But I don't know, there might be more than two, I would say about seven. And in those
okay.
seven might be differentiations as well.
Okay, that's fair. Okay.
And at one time I thought I had heard that the Torah was God's blueprint
okay.
for making the world. So that was like that existed before.
That the Torah existed before the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're bringing up a very well taken point, which is that maybe there was besides the world. You said the Torah. I asked, where is the Torah beginning? Is it beginning truly at the beginning? And you're saying, well, obviously not, because if the Torah existed before the world, then God created that first. But the Torah couldn't write that. The Torah couldn't write God created the Torah, because that would be right, that would be a circular, because the Torah is supposed
yeah.
to come first.
Uh-huh.
So okay. That's a good point. And was there anything else that God created before the world? Right.
Do we know that there wasn't?
Do we know there wasn't what?
A world before our world.
Oh, you're saying even a world before our world.
Yeah.
I can't say that we know there wasn't. You know, that's what we need to discover here in the first 6 days. You're suggesting perhaps there was another world before ours. Also, who knows? To answer the question of what God is doing here with calling Rakia Shamayim, the way it works is as follows. You have, as I mentioned, the first verse, God created Shamayim, which means the spiritual realm, and the Eretz, which is the physical realm. Even if you read it as in the beginning of God's creating the spiritual realm and the physical realm, etc., but that is what it means. On day two, God created a physical item called the Rakia. Now, whether it's the atmosphere, whether it's the solar system, whether it's the galaxy, whether it's space in general, but God created something in the physical universe called Rakia. God called that Shamayim, which means that we human beings relate to the Rakia as Shamayim. That means the Rakia is not the Shamayim. The Shamayim is spiritual. Rakia is physical. But God called it Shamayim because from the human perspective, if you want to look for God, what do? You look up. If you want to think spiritually, you look up. That is the way human beings react to the heavens, what we call the heavens. I'm not talking about heaven as in where the angels are, but we call the sky, space, etc. We relate to that realm as Shamayim, as the spiritual realm. It's not the spiritual realm, but there is some, let's put it this way, of all physical things that there are in the world, the Rakia is the one which is closer to being spiritual. I don't mean to say that it's physically closer to the spiritual realm, because where is the spiritual realm? Can you talk about being physically closer to something spiritual? By definition, if it's spiritual, it's not physical, so you can't be physically closer to it. I can't take a step closer to something spiritual, because spirituality is not physical. I can be more spiritual, but you can't walk or move or fly to something closer to spirituality, because spirituality is not physical. But you can say that something is closer in the sense that it is more reminiscent of the spiritual. When you talk about or look at this item, you become, or you're dealing with something which conjures up more spirituality. Now, just as an aside, what I said is not 100% true, because I told you a lie. Now, what I said is not 100% true because we know that there are places that are more spiritual on this world. For instance, Shul, Yerushalayim, Israel, the Beis HaMikdash. Those are places that are imbued with spirituality. And when you walk and get closer to those places, you are physically closer to spirituality. But that's not because you're closer to the spiritual realm. That's because that physical item has been imbued with spirituality. So you're physically closer to that physical item. And since that physical item is imbued with spirituality, you're now closer to something spiritual. But it's not that the spiritual realm has a physical dimension to it. It's spiritual. It's a very difficult concept to be aware of. My Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Weinberg, Zechon Baruch of blessed memory, said this all the time. He said, he used to talk about angels and about God's chariot and God's throne, etc. And he would say, so you think that, he was talking about us, he said, you think that these things we're talking about, they're conceptual. There's the conceptual throne of God, the conceptual chariot of God, the angels. He said, the spiritual realm is as real as anything that we have in the physical realm. This table is real. Angels are just as real. This book is real. The throne of God is just as real. But you can't touch it. You can't look, you see it. It's in the spiritual realm. It's a different dimension. It has different rules, but it exists with all the reality that the physical realm exists in. Now, this does bring up another point, which we're going to have to delve into in more depth later, which is that when we were first created, I don't mean we, the people in this room, but when Adam was first created and Chava was first created, they understood the spiritual realm on the level that we understand the physical realm. When they were created, the world was a perfect balance between the physical and the spiritual. A perfect balance. And again, the way Rabbi Weinberg brought it out is, when you stub your toe, it hurts. When you don't, let's say you don't daven, you don't feel pain. You don't feel any serious lack. When you haven't eaten in 12 hours, you feel hungry. When you don't daven all day, you don't feel some sort of a hunger. You may feel a certain lack of spirituality on a certain level, but it's much more subtle. Before Adam and Chava sinned by eating from the tree, their sense of spirituality was as real as their sense of physicality, which means that had they not eaten, then we here today, just as if we don't eat in 12 hours, we feel hungry, if we wouldn't daven, or wouldn't study Torah, or wouldn't do a mitzvah, we would feel hungry. Not only physically, there would be whatever that sense would be in the spiritual realm. We can't even describe it in words because we never felt it before, what it really is. But there would be a sense of lack, a sense of need. I need to be spiritual. It was just as real, because spirituality is just as real as physicality. And the two realms are equally real. But after eating from the tree, there was a diminishing in the perception of spirituality and an increase in the perception of physicality. And that's why today we are in this position that we're in, that we appreciate physicality. I haven't eaten, I'm hungry. I stub my toe, it hurts. But we don't appreciate spirituality in the same way. If I don't daven, I don't study Torah, I don't do a mitzvah, yeah, you know, it bothers me a little bit. I can very easily forget all about it. I can very easily get involved in something else and it won't bother me anymore. That's a function of the sin. But in reality, these two realms are equally real. In the beginning, God created the heavens, meaning the spiritual realm, and the physical realm. What's the very next verse? V'ha'aretz ha'isa sohu v'avohu. And this physical realm, what was it? From this point on, from verse 2 and on, the Torah describes only the physical realm. The spiritual realm got one word or two words. Eis HaShamayim. That's it. That's the spiritual realm. He also created the physical realm, Eis HaAretz. Now the Torah goes on. You want to know what the physical realm is all about? V'haaretz, haisa, sohu, vavohu, etc., etc., etc. All 31 verses, or 30 verses after verse 1, are all about the physical realm. Spiritual realm is not described in the Torah.
Yes. So since our spiritual sensitivity is lacking
today,
we help to remind ourselves about its existence, even though we don't sense it, by, for instance, not eating before we first daven, feeding our soul before feeding our body. And then we remind ourselves that if we were more sensitive, we would do that instinctively, feed our soul before feeding our body.
It's brought out in many more ways than that. Really, all of the Torah is addressing this problem. The entire Torah really is addressing this lack, that we don't have the need for spirituality. So the Torah gives us many, 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 many opportunities to do mitzvos, because we have to keep doing them, because otherwise we won't. A person cannot forget that they haven't eaten in 3 days. But it's very easy to forget that you haven't been spiritual in 3 days.
But light also was first was created as something spiritual, because later he was replaced. This light was replaced by the light of sun and moon.
Okay. So the light. What is this light?
Yes.
Okay. There was many of the questions revolved around this light. Okay. The Talmud in Chagiga says that there were actually 10 things created on day one. On day one, 10 things were created. They are, I don't know if I remember all 10 of them, but they are, of course, light and darkness. That's obvious. But also, wind, because it says Ruach Elokim, or I shouldn't say wind, Ruach, whatever Ruach is going to be translated as, but that was created on day one. Mayim, water, was created on day one. It says Mayim. land, or I should say, I shouldn't say land, excuse me, Shamayim and Eretz, the spiritual realm, the physical realm. The Gemara says, Midas Yom and Midas Laila, the measure of the day and the measure of the night. Time is created on day one. All these things are all created on day one. People focus on night and day. My kindergartner came home appropriately with a project that said that on day one, light and darkness was created, which is true, but it goes beyond that. There were many more things were created on day one. There is something else created on day one called Tohu and Bohu. Tohu Vavohu. What does that mean? You're smiling.
Emptiness and darkness.
Okay. Emptiness and darkness, I think. Let's see. I'm looking on the side over here. It says... But you know, but you're right. It says astonishingly empty. So, in the translation, okay, good. In the translation, and I'm sorry to pick on the Stone translation. It's not that they did a bad job translating. The translating is very difficult in the first 31 verses. But they translated it as astonishingly empty. So they chose to use an adverb in place of a noun. But the Gemara makes it clear that both words are really a noun. Each one, there's tohu and there's bohu.
What are they?
What are they? Great question. I wish I knew the answer. Emptiness. Void. You need another word like that.
How do you create emptiness?
Yeah, how do you create emptiness? Nothingness. Well, not nothingness, emptiness.
I think you used to learn all the chaos.
Chaos.
One of the words that they used to tell us.
Okay, chaos. Chaos. Whatever it is that these words mean, but they are, the Ramban explains, Nachmanides explains, they are the building blocks of everything else. God created two substances. He describes them, he says that they are daka ma'od. Very, what does the word daka mean? Daka usually means thin. He doesn't here mean he doesn't, his the sense here is not thin, but almost like it doesn't exist. A very, very, very Daka.
Like a very fine line.
Scant.
Scant. Some sort of substance.
Not air.
Like air or something like that, which is almost not there.
It can't be empty but filled with air.
Something. There was something they created which was almost not there. There's something there, but it's almost not there. And from those two substances, Tohu and Bohu, he then went on to create the rest of the world. The Ramban says that the truth is that, you know, the God created Yesh Me'ayin. He created something from nothing. Everything else is created from something else, as we know, in the universe today. Whenever anybody makes a discovery or something happens that's new, it's always simply a transformation of energy that was already there. But there is the laws of nature dictate that everything is there and it just gets transformed to other forms. But God created something from nothing. The Ramban explains that only happened once when he created Tohu and Bohu. That was something from nothing. After that, it's something from something. Now, everything is built on that. So, you asked before that did God create everything from nothing, or do you start with fire, water, air, and earth? The answer is he actually started with something even more fine than those four elements, but he started with Tohu and Bohu, from there created everything else. But yes, the various Kabbalistic Svarim, the various Kabbalistic sources say that those are the four basic elements. Now obviously when they use the word element, they don't mean elements in a scientific sense, but that those are the four things that everything is made up of. What they are referring to is that these four, we'll call them elements, have certain properties, and depending on what an item is made up of, it will follow those properties. So air, it goes up into the air is light, and earth is heavy, and fire consumes, etc., etc., etc. That's beyond the scope of our discussion. But they do talk about those four things as being the basics of all items, which is true. Yes?
Does Rashi shed any light on Tohu
Rashi calls it, says about emptiness and astonishingly empty and complete void. So it's not clear exactly what Rashi means to say, whether it was a state of being or a creation. The Gemara and the Ramban, building on the Gemara, says that these two things were created. They were something that were created, not a description of something that already was. Now, there is a point I want to make, but I don't want to get off into the... let's finish this discussion first, and there's a point I want to make before we're finished for tonight. Now, as we go through over here, what is very important to note is that if the entirety of creation is condensed into 31 verses, then obviously we're not being told the whole story, right? Obviously we're being given headings. We're being given an outline. But clearly we're not being given the details. What I mean to say is, when you get later on, let's say this week's parasha, Lech Lecha, we're given a lot of details of Avraham Avinu's life and Sarah's life and what they did, and especially in Vayera, what they did with the three guests and Yitzchak's birth, etc., etc. A lot of details. Here, you're talking about very, very general discussion of creation. And so, it's not like we can look at this and say, oh, this is all the information. This is the information that God chose to put in the Torah. But this is not obviously all the information. Rashi starts off his discussion in Chumash by saying that the Torah did not need to begin with Bereishis. Where should the Torah have begun? What's that? Anybody know?
Lech Lecha.
Not Lech Lecha?
Laws,
okay. Which law?
The commandment of the time and
get a new moon.
You should establish the
new moon in Parshas Bo.
Time for yourself.
Skip all of the book of Bereishis and start with in Parshas Bo, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, which is the first law that we were given. That's where the Torah could have started and should have started. There was really no need to start with Bereishis. Rashi asks it for a question. Why would the Torah start with Bereishis? And Rashi has an answer, and I don't want to get sidetracked in that answer. Why is there a question? Didn't God have to tell us in the Torah that He created the heavens and the earth? How could the Torah have started with HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim? This is the new month, and this is the first law of the Torah. What about who created the world? Don't you have to start from the beginning?
You have to establish His authority.
Establish His authority? It seems clear from Rashi, and Rashi is really building on what the sages say, it seems clear that our belief that God created the world does not come from the first verse in the Torah. Bereishis bara Elokim es hashamayim ve'es haaretz, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is not where we know that God created the heavens and the earth. Meaning that had it been word of mouth, transmitted from parents to children and from teachers to students throughout the generations, that would have been sufficient. It is not necessary to have verses telling us that God created, so that we know God created. It may be important for other reasons to tell us how He created or what He created first or why He created, etc. But that it was God that did it, it's not needed to be written in the Torah. How do we know that there is a God? How do we know there's a God?
It's intuitive.
There are people out there who don't believe it.
We hear it every year on Pesach. Our sages tell us that we heard this at Mount Sinai.
Okay. So the way we know that there is a God and the way we know that the Torah is true comes from Mount Sinai. It is from the revelation at Har Sinai that we know about God. Yes, our forefathers knew about it before that, but that we as a nation know about God, that we as a nation are aware of the truth of God, comes from Har Sinai. Everything comes from there. And really the whole discussion of how you know the Torah is authentic is a discussion that revolves around Har Sinai, not a discussion that revolves around Bereishis. You often hear a question, and I'm not sure if I should be thrilled that nobody asked this question before, or maybe nobody wanted to ask the question before, but you often hear this question. The question is, we have a conflict. We have a conflict between our belief system and science. Because science holds that the universe is roughly 15 billion years old, and we believe that the world was created 5,767 years ago. And that would seem to be a pretty significant conflict. And how do we deal with this conflict? Or you could say the conflict differently. We believe that God created the world in 6 days. Science believes it took a lot more time than that for things to develop. Or science believes in evolution, that things evolved over time, and we say that no, that God created things as they were. So you often hear these conflicts. How shall we word this? Let's word it this way. I don't want to embarrass anybody. The way I would say it is, is there anybody in this room that these conflicts do not bother at all? That no, these are not issues for them. One. Okay? Two. Three. Four.
What was your question?
Is there anybody in here that these issues, these conflicts, are not conflicts? They're nothing. These questions are not relevant. They're not important. It doesn't bother you. It doesn't bother you. Okay. Good. That's a good thing. For many people, it does bother them. Now, it's important to note that there are many answers. If these things are conflicts in your mind, there are many answers to these questions. And these are really not major, major issues. The whole question of, does God know, and how do we have free will, is a much stronger question than this apparent conflict. The apparent conflict has many, many ways out. But I want to present to you the most obvious of answers it really removes any room for a question to begin with. And that is as follows. Science, the whole way science works, and the whole scientific method is that you investigate the physical universe, you discover whatever it is that you discover, and you build a system of laws based on your observations. Nothing can be proven true unless there is evidence that is both demonstrable and consistent. You have to be able to show that it can happen on a consistent basis, and you have to be able to show it. It can't be something that you can simply guess or surmise. It has to be something which is clearly demonstrable and consistent. You can suggest things, but that wouldn't be proven to be a law. So the way scientists will view the history of the world is they will look around at the world today or within the past 100 years, 200 years, whatever evidence there is available to them, look around and say, this is the evidence we have in front of us. We will extrapolate backwards to what we think is the beginning. And that will go back to a certain point, and today that number is believed to be around 15 billion years. The most basic reason why there's no conflict is because that paradigm is false. We know that paradigm is false. We know that anybody who buys into that paradigm is necessarily going to make mistakes, and significant ones. Because we don't believe that the world has always followed the same rules as you find today. For example, when you want to give someone a bracha, they should live to be how old? 120 years. How long did Adam live? 930 years. Is that allegorical? No. He lived to be 930 years old. How long did Noah live? 950 years old. That's what happened. It's not some kind of a concept or an allegory or that's what happened. They lived to be that long. People lived to be extremely old. Were they frail at the age of 800? No. More than that. People age, and people as they age, they look their age. That's what happens. It's a bracha if a person could say, oh, you look so young. Did Adam look old at the age of 900? No. Who's the first person to look old? You're right about something else, but... Huh?
Abraham.
Abraham's the first person to look old. He didn't look old. Nobody looked old until then. That means you had 900-year-old people who looked like young men. Now, let's go to the Yaakov. Did people become sickly as they got old?
No.
No? Who's the first person to get sick before they died? Yaakov. Before that point, how would people die?
Sneeze.
They would sneeze. That's why we say, bless you, when people sneeze. Because that was the way people died. Because God blew into Adam's nostrils his soul, and he sneezes the soul out. I don't think it means that every time a person sneezes, they die. I think there could have been sneezes without that. But, I don't know. But or maybe no, because they were never sick. So maybe there were no sneezes. I don't know. But at any rate, that's the way they died. So there was no sickness in that way. There was no sickness in that way. So things have changed dramatically since the time God created the world. I'll give you more examples. You know that the flood we just read about. Well, what happened 7 days before the flood? A significant event happened 7 days before the great Mabul. Okay, Mesushelach died. He was 969 years old, the oldest recorded life. 969 years old, and he died. So for the next 7 days, people were sitting Shiva for Mesushelach. And that was, God was hoping that they would do Teshuvah because of that. Rashi tells us in Koheles, based on Chazal, that during those 7 days, the sun rose in the west and set in the east for those 7 days. In order to frighten the people. Oh my, what's happening? What's going on? Maybe it'll get them to turn around and to turn over a new leaf. It didn't work, of course. But the sun rose in the west and set in the east. Imagine that for a scientist. How are you going to figure that one out? Did the world start spinning the other way? Did the sun move somewhere else? What happened over there? Let's move on to seasons. In Parshas Noach, also this past week's Parsha, it says after the flood that God promises that from now on He won't bring a flood, and from now on all the seasons will run the way they're supposed to run. Winter will follow fall, spring will follow winter, summer will follow spring, fall will follow summer. Everything will go the way it's supposed to go. Again, Chazal tell us, before the flood, there were no seasons. It was perennially mild. Everything was like San Diego. All year round, everywhere. It was pleasant everywhere. There were no seasons. Does that mean that the earth wasn't on an axis? Because as you know, that's how the seasons happen, because the earth is on an axis. So does that mean there was none? Was the earth spinning straight up and down instead of on a tilt? But then again, if that were true, then the days shouldn't get longer or shorter, and the nights shouldn't get longer or shorter. They should be the same amount of time all year round if there's no tilt. But the Gemara tells us clearly that after Adam was thrown out of Gan Eden, which happened Rosh Hashanah time, and he's thrown out of Gan Eden, then the nights started getting longer and the days started getting shorter. The Gemara tells us this in Maseches Avodah Zarah. Nights started getting longer, days started getting shorter. It went on and on, and Adam said, oh no, because of my sin, God will take away the light forever. Eventually, the nights will get so long and the days get so short that the days will be non-existent, and we will have only darkness because of my sin. Then, at the winter solstice, all of a sudden, the opposite happened. Now the days started getting longer, the nights began to get shorter, and Adam realized that no, there still will be light. And he made a holiday to celebrate the light. That holiday became a pagan holiday, a worship of the light, which does not coincidentally coincide with December 25th, with the Christian holiday as well. That was always a pagan holiday around that time, celebrating the light, which goes back to Adam realizing that the light is not going to disappear forever. You'll say that it's celebrating the birth. It's not celebrating the birth. It seems clear it was not at that time, but it was moved to that time because there was a pagan holiday anyway, and it made Christianity palatable to the masses. If you check out the history, you'll see that that's essentially what happened over there. So there was a difference between the length of days and the length of nights, but there were no seasons. Well, how does that explain? Is the earth on an axis? Is it not on an axis? What I'm trying to show you is that we don't believe that the way you can do scientific research today applies to the past. And it also doesn't apply to the future. The Talmud tells us in the future, the sun will increase in light many, many times. 7 times 7 times 7, 7 cubed, it says. What will that mean? A supernova? Who knows? How will we survive that? But it's going to increase in light. The wicked people will be destroyed by it. The righteous will be blessed by it. Who knows what that means?
Is that the Messianic light or something different?
Who knows? Who knows? The Rambam says don't get involved in figuring these things out because you'll get it wrong. He says. The point is that science is a great tool. I'm not here to bash science. Science is a great tool to understand the here and now, to understand how things work right in front of us. But when they start getting into the distant past, or I'll add, the distant distance, cosmology, then they're out of their league because they don't really know what they're looking at and they don't really understand what they're discovering, because the rules are not necessarily the same. I once heard a joke, that three scientists went on a trip to Scotland. Three of them. There was a mathematician, a physicist, and a cosmologist. And they were on a hilltop looking over the countryside, and they saw off in the distance a black cow. A black cow. So the cosmologist remarked, it must be, look at that, a black cow. Cows in Scotland must be black. Look at that, a black cow. So the physicist turned to the cosmologist and said, how do you know that? You can't say that. All you know is that one cow in Scotland is black. You don't know that all cows are black. How can you jump to conclusions and say they're all black? One is black, you don't know about anything else. The mathematician turned to both of them and said, you're both wrong. All you know is that one side of one cow viewed from one angle is black. That is essentially what I'm trying to bring out. That science is very, very good for something which is here and now, right in front of your eyes. But when you get into the distant past and you get into the distances, et cetera, they're working with a paradigm that we know we don't work with. We don't believe that all the rules that are applicable today were necessarily applicable all the way through. I don't mean to say that the laws of nature have changed. What I mean to say is that we know God deviated from the laws of nature. He caused miracles. Rashi tells us during the flood took a year. During the flood, the sun and moon did not function. They did not function. They ceased to function during the time of the flood. They remained, I don't know what God did with them, put them away somewhere, but they did not function during the flood. After the flood, God set them in motion again. What does that do to all of the calculations of the past? What does it do that the sun went backwards? These things are things that obviously will throw off calculations incredibly. And in order to really understand the past, you have to take these things into account. And since they're not willing to, because the very foundation of science is based on that everything works according to the physical laws and nothing ever deviates from them, then they have to have the wrong answers. It's impossible for them to arrive at the right answers. And so these conflicts are not really conflicts. There are gross errors that are going on, not because their discoveries are wrong, not because their observations are wrong, but when they begin to extrapolate from their observations to the past, they are necessarily making mistakes because they're not willing to take into account what we know is true. So the whole discussion is really it's apples and oranges, and it becomes an exercise in futility to try to make the two things work out, because one is false and one is true. Let me conclude tonight's discussion with one more point, and then we will for next week I'll ask you all to please have a stone chumash handy. You know what? I don't want to do this because my thought is going to go over time, and I hate to keep people over time. It's a fault of mine. So we're not going to take that risk. Let me instead conclude with a couple of announcements for this class. First of all, if anybody did not sign the sign-up sheet that went around, I would appreciate it if you would and leave your phone number so that we know who to contact when there are reasons to contact. This room is a nice size room, but it seems that we are kind of full for this room. I'm happy to do it elsewhere. Anybody, should we do the downstairs conference room, upstairs conference room? This is a joint Ask and Beth Jacob class, so we can use Beth Jacob's facilities. Anybody? Okay. Okay.
Well,
okay.
Rooms can be set up the way they're requested, but you have to find out from.
Yeah, I can speak to Andrew. Sunday night is usually an empty night. Usually 8 o'clock is.
Conference room has tables already.
Okay, so should I ask Andy for the upstairs conference room?
It's also close to the bathroom.
Okay, so I will ask Andy if we can have the upstairs conference room, and that's where everybody should go next week. If for whatever reason that doesn't work out, we will have a sign over there saying where to go.
So going through the front door.
You can. You have to use the code. You could. You could do that.
Can
yeah.
we just finish up the two
no,
other
it's still
things
there.
That were created?
It's not always that.
Go ahead. Which? Can I only say eight?
You only said eight that I caught.
Okay, let me go through one more time. Okay, hold on. There's Shamayim and Eretz.
Right.
Okay. Tohu and Bohu.
Uh-huh.
Choshech and Or.
Okay.
Ruach. Mayim. Right?
Yeah.
Water.
Measure of day and night.
Measure day and night. Measure of day, measure of night.
Yeah. So what
happens? I think. I have to look this up. Unless the other one is the Tahom, which is the depths.
Right, but what happens to the Leviathan, the two talking donkeys, the big fish of Noah? What happens to all those other things that were supposedly on the first day?
They're not here. That's what I was trying to say before, that this is only generalities. This is not everything, by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
Right? It's not here. There's many, many, there's much more going on that is not printed over here. Yeah.
What you said about conflict between science and our perception about the creation, it's convincing for people who really believe in God, but the Hashem created everything. For scientists, what you said, it is not convincing because they don't believe Noah exists, but
right.
Adam lived
right.
950 years.
Right.
So how you can resolve this conflict? For example, they say that they had archaeologists found some Neanderthals, bones that some intermediate like people, but not like now people, but something between monkeys and
right.
People.
Right. There's a very interesting. There's a very interesting answer.
No, this American.
There's a very interesting answer to that one also.
Yes, so
they're misunderstanding that also.
For, to people who do not
yeah.
believe so, but Adam lives.
You're right. You can't convince them. Someone who doesn't believe in God, they don't believe any of this is true. So of course not. But someone who does believe in the Torah and does believe in Hashem might feel threatened by these quote-unquote discoveries. So what I'm trying to show is these discoveries are not discoveries. They're mistakes. The discoveries are true, and that's what they see in front of their eyes are true, but what they are extrapolating from them is necessarily false, because we know that there are things that happen that they're not taking into account. But you're right, I'm not trying to convince them. someone doesn't want to believe in the Torah, they don't have, there's nothing, you can't, what are you going to do? Tell them, well, the Torah says that the sun went backwards. Yeah, but I don't believe in the Torah. So, right?
Is Gerald Schroeder coming?
Yeah, so Gerald Schroeder, what he likes to do is to take the show how the 6 days of creation can be 24 hours and at the same time can be 15 billion years old using Einstein's theory of relative time, which is very nice. What he did is actually very, very interesting. But I don't think it's necessary. I don't think you have to go there, because he's trying to use a system that is false and make it work out with a system that is true. There's no need for that. They're making mistakes in their calculations. But yeah, what he did is actually very interesting. It's very interesting.
And the Gemara, the Gemara that says that Hashem created a measure of night and day is the problem.
It says it says 24 hours.
Yeah.
The Rashi over there says 24 hours. So what Dr. Schroeder is trying to do is show that it can be 24
hours
and 15 billion years at the same time, because it's relative time. And it, depending on how fast you're moving, time moves faster and slower. So that for one person or one place in the universe, it could be 24 hours, and another place it could be 15 billion years. That's his theory, and he does a beautiful job of it. But I have the tape if you want to listen to it. It's very, very interesting. But I think it's not a necessary thing to say. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Did you?
So you want to come downstairs and I'll just download.